I'm Shannon McCurchy, and you are listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 Ecology with Pat Greer and H.C. Clark.
Thank you so much, Shannon. We appreciate that. Well, the weather is back on us.
It is. Unfortunately, it is here, so be careful.
Yeah, just be careful. Water can get deep really fast on these streets here in Houston. So, and I believe that most of us have experienced that or know someone who has had trouble with that in the not too distant past. So please be aware of your surroundings at all time, which I think is a perfect lead in to our book, The Texas Landscape Project. David Todd is joining us today. He's a co-author of The Texas Landscape Project. It's called Nature and People. David Todd and Jonathan Ogren. Ogren?
That's correct, Ogren.
And it's an absolutely beautiful book, very detailed, very comprehensive, that talks about our state, the Lone Star State. David has a degree in architecture and urban planning. He's in environmental science from Rice, from Emory. He's founder and executive director for the Conservation History Association of Texas, co-editor of the Texas Legacy Project, Stories of Courage and Conservation, and co-authored this book. And he's quite a diversified soul.
And hard to focus.
Well, you know, I think that that's a wonderful thing. Instead of being deficient in attention, I think that we have a lot of attention focused on a lot of different things. It's able to give a very large global view.
Well, it's a big state.
And
a lot of things, though, connected from, you know, whether you're in the big thicket in East Texas or out in the high plains of the Panhandle or down in the lower Rio Grande Valley, the south, there are a number of themes that seem to echo and repeat themselves from one end of the state to the other. So it's easy to get distracted, but you get sort of recovered by seeing these same repeating themes once and again. So,
what brought you to this project? What took you here?
Well, my background is in law, which I think is a kind of useful tool, but it can be a little tedious.
What kind of law?
I practice environmental law in Texas. Worked for the State Air Pollution Control Agency for a while and helped some nonprofit groups out after that. I often felt like it was speaking a language that a lot of people didn't understand or didn't find really accessible, and so I've sort of branched off into these two different ways to try to explain the environmental concerns that I think that you and HC share with me and many of your listening audience. The first project was something called the Texas Legacy Project, which was basically a collection of oral histories, and the thought was that if we could put these sort of environmental concerns in vernacular and how people talk every day to their family and friends and not use the sort of stilted legal engineering jargon, that people would make a connection with those individuals that we interviewed and that we included in this book, The Texas Legacy Project, and maybe incorporate those ideas in their own lives. So that was a book and a video archive that wrapped up about 6 years ago now. And the book was published by Texas A&M Press. And there's a wonderful woman there named Shannon Davies, who was our editor for this first book, Texas Legacy Project. And she was kind enough to ask, well, what are you going to do now? And I thought that was like a perfect opening to thinking about other ways to talk about the environment and again, trying to avoid words on a page as much as possible. And so that's where this new book, The Texas Landscape Project, came from. And it's basically an atlas so that where the old project, The Texas Legacy Project, was more about spoken word and the sort of audio way to explain things, this is more about visual tools and a visual window into the environment. So I'm hoping that people feel like it's an effective way to talk about these things.
It certainly I mean, there's the maps that are in this book are so telling, and I haven't had time to sit down and really read the entire book, but I was fascinated with the images of the port, the Port Authority, and Galveston Bay. It just really shows what's happening.
I think a lot of us feel a connection with visual, you know, ways of looking at the world. It's we are creatures, maybe like hawks or, you know, raptors that we take in the world through our eyes in large extent. And I think that not only the visual way of looking at things and accepting things, but also that these maps, I think many of us grew up maybe enjoying the AAA triptychs as we mm-hmm. drove around the country, or maybe the gas station maps that we might have picked up, or the Rand McNally atlases that might have, you know, sat high on a shelf somewhere at home as a window into the world that might have taken us to places far away that you know, sort of enlarged our horizons. So I'm hoping that there are people out there that like maps and like visual materials and might, you know, be attracted to this book. I hope so.
Well, kids have and I still remember the horror of geography class, because all you were supposed to do was memorize where cities of the world were and what
capitals
and color the shape maps of Europe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the way you've told it here, and I will scan this introductory map, kind of summarizing or kind of setting out the different, well, really, things you talk about and the controversies around them. And I'd a lot rather learn from that than memorizing all the. And it'd make it a lot easier to do that memorizing if I knew a little more scandal going on. So that's what we get.
Well, it's interesting because I think sometimes the geography lessons that we all got as children were of, as you said, memorizing the names of, you know, countries and states and counties and cities. And this reminds me of one map that's in the book, which I think is sort of an interesting way to use the names of towns, but also to tell a story that maybe is more lasting than some of those towns were. And that's a map that appears in a chapter about the Big Thicket, which, as many of you know, is this area of southeast Texas that you know, is heavily forested and, in fact, was heavily timbered for many years. And so there's a map that we, I think, enjoyed making because it basically shows all the communities that had a post office and then lost their post office, which is sort of like the birth and the death of a town. So if you can map these communities that have lost their post office and their way of communicating with the outside world, you realize that that community has been snuffed out. And the reason they were snuffed out in the Big Thicket is that the trees were cut around these little towns. They were basically logging camps. So this map of lost post offices is sort of by virtue of you know, the logging industry there, is also a story about how East Texas and the Big Thicket were clear cut. And so I think that map is a way of telling people a story. And I'm hoping that's a sort of accessible way for people to learn about not only Texas geography and where these towns were and their names and so on, but also learn a little bit about logging and the forest culture that we've had in Texas for many, many generations.
And the history.
I once
heard that every one of those East Texas towns used to have a creosoting plant and a plating shop. And thus, most of them had an environmental problem after all those logging companies moved on.
I would think that's probably so.
The telephone pole business was big.
Well, the overview map that's just right in the beginning of the book is fascinating because it's talking about land, water, wildlife, built world, energy, and air. There's brown pelican, there's ozone hole, there's coastal storms, and these are dots like they would be cities. Bighorn sheep. Talk to us about this.
Well, there are 40 chapters in the book, and as you said, they range over four or five major themes: land, water, energy, air quality, wildlife, and then the built world. Maybe an easy way, since we're talking about this in Houston, is to maybe visit a little bit about some of the issues that are described in the book that were part of Houston's history. And I think you mentioned the brown pelican, and I think that that's a wonderful story because you know, the brown pelican is a very large seabird that is now a big part of the Texas coast, the upper Texas coast in particular. And yet, in the early 60s, it was virtually extinct on the Texas coast. And so it's this wonderful story of success and survival and of the great effect of the Endangered Species Act sort of writ out in the story of this one bird. And, you know, basically they figured out in the early 60s that the bird was being terribly harmed by two pesticides, DDT and Endrin. And by banning those two pesticides and severely regulating them, the bird began to make a great rebound. And now it's, you know, you see it on every marina and dock and wharf and groin all along the Texas coast. So it's a wonderful story about how effective concerted conservation efforts can be, and that we should never lose faith in the fact that you can solve these problems.
The Big Thicket is an example, another example of kind of a revival of an area based on something that has gone by and brought back, and it became a favorite project of a number of people. But each one of these things, I mean, I'm just taking a travel down history lane here, and I remember early on when I came to Texas, we had a governor who was from West Texas who felt that it would be okay to move water from East Texas to West Texas, and West Texas would bloom, and Lubbock would be an oasis. You remember that? And then you've got a part in here about water involved with a Grand Canal from Dallas to Houston.
That's
and I remember
true.
That just being, boy, that was that to me was the first activist thing that I got involved in.
You know, it's interesting, those two projects. I think the first one you're talking about was called the Texas Water Plan.
Yes.
And indeed, it foresaw bringing water from the Mississippi all the way out to the High Plains and then again down through, I think they called it Burley's Ditch, that was going to bring water to irrigate the lower Rio Grande Valley. And you have to hand it to the state's leaders at the time that they thought big. They thought without limits. And, you know, so you've got to admire their entrepreneurial attitude, but you've got to sort of question their sense of sanity.
at the same time.
It's Texas, though, uh-huh.
Well, but the wonderful thing is that the Texans, I think, have a sense of proportion limits that you wouldn't maybe expect, because in the late 60s, this Texas water plan was taken to a vote.
How did it get to a vote?
Well, I think that there was a very large bond issue that was going to be required to pay for hundreds
sure.
of miles of canals, pipelines. They were talking about over a dozen nuclear plants that were going to be needed to pump this water, I think 3,000 or 4,000 feet up to the High Plains and you know, across hundreds of miles of Texas. So there was a big price tag, and in I think it was in 69, the voters in Texas said no. So it's curious to me, because I think Texas often has this reputation of being not really favorable to environmental issues. But again and again, we kept finding where that's not entirely so. And there have been time and again that these citizens have voted and paid to have conservation done in the state, you know, whether it's for land or water or wildlife protection, you know, really through the gamut.
How do you feel? Well, we will talk about that as soon as we get back from break. But how do you feel the environmental issues are being addressed today? I mean, you've written this book to give us really a history and something to have a basis, a visual base, and then, I mean, just to be able to read about this and attach it to a history piece with it. How do you feel like our environment is impacted now through projects like this? I mean, I guess what do you hope to achieve with this? Let's talk about that when we get back from break, and I'm going to have a better formed question because it's floating around in my mind and it didn't come out the way I wanted
to. It's floating there.
It's floating. Okay, we're going to take care of that, and I'll get it all worked out, and we'll have a real question when we come back from break. Stay with us. It's 31 minutes past the hour, and this is Ecology on your radio station, KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas. Shannon?
Thank you,
to
Pat.
You.
Okay. And let's take a brief look at weather around town. It's currently 76 degrees and dropping with these thunderstorms with locally heavy downpours moving through our area. Flash flood warning for northern Galveston County and extreme southeastern Harris County and aerial flood advisories in southwestern Montgomery County. And since these rainstorms have come, there are four high water locations around town at this moment, including but not limited to on the Northwest Freeway. Outbound at West, the right lane is flooded. On the East Loop northbound at Clinton, the right and two center lanes are underwater at this moment. And on the East Freeway, inbound at Holland Avenue, two center lanes to the left shoulder are submerged in high water, as well as three frontage road lanes along the Gull Freeway. Inbound at Brittany Bay, underwater at this moment. And you're tapping on the brakes. There's quite a bit of traffic around town with these thunderstorms moving through. You're tapping on the brakes on 288 between 59 and Beltway 8. Quite a lot of traffic on the loop in general, all around the loop. And on the Gulf Freeway from Monroe to downtown in both directions, you are tapping on the brakes. That's a look at your Houston area weather and traffic. I'm Shannon McCurchy, and you are listening to KPFT Houston 90.1. Back to you, Pat and HC.
So we're going to have a little bit of music from our Bradley Dean White. We're going to listen to Ladybug, Ladybug. Just kind of tempt you a little bit with his opening that's going to be at the, well, I guess he's calling it a CD release. It's going to be his CD release. It's at the Children's Museum, and that's this Thursday around 6:30.
My thumb, then crawl onto my wrist, and crawl to my elbow. Oh, ladybug, ladybug, crawl up my arm, and then she flew away.
One, two, three, four,
ladybug, ladybug. My toe, and crawl onto my ankle, and crawl up to my knee. Oh, ladybug, ladybug, crawl up my leg, and then she flew away. Oh, ladybug, ladybug. My brain.
ladybugs. I love ladybugs. What a sweet song.
Jeffrey Sains was on before us.
Yes.
And
King of Grief.
The King of Grief, and he was presenting songs from 1991. And I was struck by how it sounded like all the singing involved giant choruses, and I know it didn't. I think it didn't.
There were some choruses
and appeared to come from a very large venue. Like there was an echo to them. And I don't know if that was a discovery of technology or they were just enamored with that.
We'll talk to him about it next time. Jeffrey, if you're still listening, we'd like to know.
He puts on a real show every week. He just researches all the great things from the past.
Boy, there's some good music on KPFT. Just at any, you know, you can turn it on, and Warwick's got a different show every day. And then every single day we have a different music that's presented. I just love it.
Larry Winters comes on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Those guys get going on Saturday.
It's great.
And a lot of stuff goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Great to listen to.
We do love our radio station. And we know you do, too, because you're listening to it, KPFT. So we're visiting in the studio today with David Todd. And we're talking about the Texas Landscape Project. It's an incredible book about nature and people right here in our state. It is a visual wonder. It takes you through. There's maps that HC's got the book open right now to a checkerboard of water regulation. So there's water, there's air quality, and how it's changed. There's the history to it is so telling. So I was trying to form a question before we went on our break.
How'd that work out?
Well, I think it came up with a portion of one, and it will evolve. When I look at this book, I want to do something more than just read it. It's like, this is my state. I love Texas. I'm a Texan. I'm seventh generation Texan. I love this state. And when I look at this book, I want to do something. I almost don't even know where to start.
Well, you
give
know
me
what,
some advice.
Well, I'm sure you have lots of good ideas, but one thing that I kept running across in trying to prepare the book is that, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, there was a whole spate of legislation that was passed, whether it's the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act. It goes on and on. It's a real laundry list of laws, but it was basically an age, I think, of having the government step up and finance and regulate to improve the environment. But, you fast forward, or you go forward slowly, 40-some years to the present day, and I think that it's a time of sort of personal empowerment and engagement where a lot of people like yourself, Pat, are trying to figure out ways that they can help themselves. And I think that there are a bunch of examples in the book that are just really encouraging. And if you don't mind, I could give a few examples.
Please do. Yes.
Okay. There are a number of chapters in the book about birds, both in very rare birds or formerly rare birds like the brown pelican, or very common birds the house sparrow or the starling or the Eurasian collared dove that have come in here and have a sort of exotic species spread problem. But the extraordinary thing is that the way a lot of us are starting to understand how these birds are behaving and moving around the state is through citizen science. It's through this sort of crowdsourced collection of data. Like if you go on an Audubon bird count over Christmas time, you'll file your reports about what birds you saw, how many you saw, where you saw them, and that gets filed with Audubon, and then it gets redistributed to scientists and researchers, and they can use it as this enormous data bank to understand where birds are at different times of the year, because this is also augmented by something called eBird, which is run by Cornell University, and again it's a sort of crowdsourced, bottom-up, grassroots way of collecting data about the natural world. So that there's that sort of science aspect that's very much about what individuals can do. And then on the other end, there's this sort of management side. And a couple examples come to mind. One is there's a program called Wildlife Exemptions. And basically it's where if you have a piece of land and it was formerly a farm or ranch, but you no longer want to cultivate it for crops or you don't want to graze it with cattle or sheep or goats, you can say, I'm going to dedicate this to being habitat for birds or butterflies or deer or whatever, and you can get a tax exemption equivalent to what you would have gotten for agricultural use from the state. So the state is, in a sense, empowering you to take your conservation, you know, mission to your own plot of land. And so that's just enormously empowering. And I think it says that, you know, the next generation is going to do great things because it allows each person to do what they feel called to do.
So you're saying that in the 60s, laws got passed not necessarily in response to kind of the 60s-isms, the 60s protest, but almost a something, a separate set of issues. I mean, even Nixon was involved in passing these laws.
That's true. You know, I think people forget how bipartisan conservation was at the time. I mean, Richard Nixon signed the law that put the Environmental Protection Agency into effect. It's unusual now to think of Republicans doing much of anything to promote environmental protection. And
do you think Nixon thought, what have I done?
I have a hard time understanding what his motives might have been, but it was enormously powerful and popular at the time. That may be what the Republican view is reflecting, is that you know, there's a lot of conflict out there now about how to best protect the environment.
And they're very powerful laws.
And it may be that, you know, that there may be some recognition that there's a lot more infrastructure, a lot more agencies and bureaucracies and laws and rules that are enforced to do a good measure of protection. But, you know, it's highly political and controversial, and it seems to split the parties right down the middle.
Let's talk about water just for a minute or so. That, you know, here we are, this huge state, and part of it is very wet and part of it is very dry. And in my recollection, there's always been a kind of a Wild West attitude toward water. And this book really puts it together. It puts together a lot of the problems associated with it. Talk a little bit about that. Start off with Houston and subsidence.
Oh, well, that's a sort of fun story if you don't live too close to the coast.
How close is too close?
Well, it's a problem. So
Shannon will tell us in a minute if it's really raining.
Right. Well, I guess one of the stories here goes back about 110 years, and basically what happened was that the Texas Supreme Court ruled that if you could drill a well, a groundwater well, and pump water out of it, that water was all yours. And it didn't matter what effect it might have on your neighbor that you were pumping that water out of the ground. So this is called the rule of capture, and it's been the law of the land in Texas pretty much without serious challenge. There have been some groundwater conservation districts that have tried to limit that, but it's been a very powerful law for the last 100-plus years. And the way that played out in Houston is that a number of the industries along the Houston Ship Channel and some of the early subdivisions to the east of town started pumping groundwater to provide processed water and cooling water for refiners and chemical plants along the ship channel, and then for drinking water for some of the communities nearby and for some irrigation. And the unfortunate thing is when they pulled this water out of the ground, the clays underneath the city basically collapsed. And if you go down to area near Baytown, there was a little subdivision, a little community called Brownwood, and it sunk by about 9 to 10 feet over the last 100 years. And that probably wouldn't be such a problem, except that it's right on Galveston and Trinity Bay. So when it sunk, it flooded, and eventually it became uninhabitable, and everybody had to be bought out and move away. And so now it's a marsh, and it's a nice little nature sanctuary, but it's no longer of somebody's home. So it's these environmental problems can strike really close to, you know, where we live and work. And, you know, these environmental laws, which may seem really abstract and dusty, can have very immediate and powerful impacts.
And creating the Harris-Galveston Coastal Subsidence District was that was a huge step. So we'll talk about that when we come back from.
Absolutely.
Let's visit with Shannon one more time, find out how things are going out there. Shannon, tell us what's happening in our KPFT land.
Well, fortunately, the thunderstorms are passing through our area, so it's not raining at the moment, but who knows? It's still coming through. So still expect that locally heavy rainfall through this evening. And so it's currently 75 degrees, and thunderstorms will continue until around midnight. We'll become partly cloudy, low of 76, and partly cloudy. Early on Wednesday, scattered thunderstorms will develop in the afternoon, high of 94 degrees. Those severe warnings will continue, including severe thunderstorm warnings for Harris County, Galveston County, Brazoria County, and Fort Bend County, as well as those aerial flood advisories in Montgomery County, and the flash flood warning right here in southeastern Harris County, a little bit south of us, of course, and northern Galveston County. So be careful, but it looks like they're continuing to move along. And let's take a brief look at our roadways. On the Katy Freeway outbound at Washington Avenue, there's an accident affecting the right lane and shoulder. Heavy traffic on the west loop in both directions from Evergreen to the Katy Freeway and northbound up to Irvington. And there still are 4 high water locations around town, including but not limited to on the Northwest Freeway. Outbound at West, the right lane is still flooded. On the East Loops northbound at Clinton, the right and 2 center lanes are underwater. Traffic is backed up to all the way to around the Katy Freeway, so heavy, heavy traffic on the loop. And on the East Freeway inbound at Holland Avenue, 2 center lanes to the left shoulder are submerged in high water. Traffic is backed up to Beltway 8. And that's a look at your Houston area weather and traffic. I'm Shannon McCurchy, and you are listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 Ecology. Back to you, Pat.
Thank you, Shannon.
So we ended up with a subsidence district. That's what it's called. But it controls the withdrawal of groundwater in our area. And that, to me, seemed to be the first groundwater control district in the state.
Yeah, that's true, and it's interesting to see how Texas has come up with solutions to sort of confront traditions and rules that we've had for a century or more. And of course, the Harris County subsidence district has been a really good example of that. And there are 4 other subsidence districts that encompass the Houston area. And they've done a good job of limiting the amount of groundwater withdrawn, and limited the amount of subsidence that's continued. Although there is still a area sort of northeast of the Attucks-Barker reservoir that's continuing to sink as subdivisions are built out there, and water is provided through these groundwater wells. But you know, I think you have to hand it to the district for trying very hard to not only limit the production of those wells, but also to bring in and encourage, I think it's called the CWA, that's brought surface water in from the Trinity River and east to try to supply surface water to folks so that they can get off the groundwater wells.
But what a remarkable thing to have happen. I mean, now we look around us, and regardless of where you look, there's gridlock, and for good or bad, but there things don't get done, and maybe that's a good thing. But then I remember we had a couple of really whopper storms, and it just beat Brownwood. I mean, it was photo op all over the place. and the legislature moved in spite of, I mean, it's a rural legislature that depends, those guys depend on groundwater, most of them do, and they were able to take the step to make a subsidence district that controlled groundwater.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the coastal storms, because I think that these natural hazards are one way that we all recognize our shared humanity, our shared mortality, and sometimes it's these major tropical storms and hurricanes that frankly scare us into doing something that needs to be done. And I'm thinking a little bit about some of the efforts that have been taken on to mitigate the impacts of coastal storms, including you think of Carla and Ike and Katrina that have hit the Houston area. And, some of them have been trying to change building code so that the houses that we build are built in, more secure way. But also there are these sort of market-based approaches where folks have changed the way the insurance premiums are calculated so that it makes it very costly to build along Galveston Island or on Bolivar, so that folks are starting to have to absorb the cost of living in a risky area, and it's not pleasant to pay those premiums, but maybe it's a way of gently dissuading people from building in a place that may threaten their lives during the next big storm.
Co-authored this book with Jonathan. What was that like? How did y'all meet? How did this project get started with the two of you?
Well, Jonathan Ogren has been a great partner in this, and I'm really glad you mentioned his name. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today, but I hope that I can channel Jonathan. And basically, he's a very talented geographer and cartographer. He teaches at the University of Texas in GIS. Geographic information system, which is sort of the way of making digital maps. And we had first met, I guess it's about 6 years ago. I have a kind of pet project in Austin involving attempts at recovering a small, maybe a 40-acre urban park that has been overtaken by a lot of exotics, ligustrum and nandina and china berries. And so I approached Jonathan about making a map of this park so we could sell the idea of how special this park was and how we needed help to try to recover it. And then he helped us with another park that's down here in the Houston area. It's called Cullinan Park. It's out near on Oyster Creek in the Sugarland area, and he built a map for that as well. And I was so impressed by his technical skills and by his good karma. He's just a good guy and very pleasant to work with. So we went ahead and worked on this book of maps, basically. I mean, it's a lot of the work is really his. And now there are 300 maps in this book, over 100 images of other kinds as well. So it's a very visual thing, and in large part thanks to Jonathan.
It's very difficult to make a good map. Take it from me. And these maps, I mean, they make the point, and they're simple.
Well, they're simple, and they tell this complete story. I mean, you've just opened it to Class 1 waste injection wells. I mean, there's everything covered in this book. Oil and gas wells, oil, waste, and water. I mean, we're open to the energy section here. And talk about this, injection wells, waste injection wells.
Well, this is sort of an interesting story for me, I think. Oil and gas is a large part of industry in Texas and certainly in Houston. But it's... there are a lot of byproducts. There's collateral damage from developing these wells. It's not like seeing strip mines, up in Wyoming or mountains being removed in West Virginia. But there is a ugly side to developing these energy sources. And one of it is, one part of it is the injections of oil field waste, and then of hazardous chemicals that are injected underground in Texas. And it's a very large collection of pinpricks all across the state. But there's sort of a positive side of some of these wells that I wanted to mention, and that is that over the years there have been a lot of wells that have been dry holes, or they've been abandoned after they've been produced, and these wells have from a very early point in Texas history there's been concern about plugging them correctly, and in the old days they didn't do the best job. You know, they would throw stumps and rocks down these old wells, and it wasn't really as professional as you might hope.
But they were out of money too.
Well, that's true. A lot of times these oil producers just didn't have the money to do it. But in any case, the state has ended up plugging maybe close to 3,000 of them in recent years. So I think that the state of Texas is a real leader in trying to resolve some of these problems with these old wells.
All of this is addressed in this beautiful book, The Texas Landscape Project. How can people find out more?
Well, thanks for asking. We are, available from Texas A&M Press, Amazon, or your close by independent bookstore. We like Brazos Bookstore if you're in the neighborhood. And speaking of Brazos, we will be there on July 18th at 7 o'clock. Jonathan will come.
All right.
So it'll be good to have him along, and we hope that you will be there too.
Thank you so much, David. What a fascinating topic. Absolutely beautiful book. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Pat, HC, thank you very much for having me on.
What a great gift. We have so many wonderful, wonderful people in our region, and we're just so thankful that we've had a hero here with us today. And we thank you with great respect and deep appreciation. We thank you for joining us today here on Ecology on your radio station, KPFT 90.1 FM. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned for the news. It is up next. It's a great day. Thank you.